We'll come to order. And I do believe we have a quorum, so our first item on the agenda doesn't require that, but I hope everybody's here to hear the work of the Minnesota School Board Association on a presentation for us to understand the labor bargaining implications from the management side. So I don't know who's going to lead this show, but welcome to our committee.
Madam Chair,
Amy, Amy Fullenkamp?
I am,
and
yes.
You are?
Okay.
So,
which I might have just
whoever, and give your name for the record and begin.
Well, Madam Chair, I just want to do a brief introduction. My name is Kirk Schneider, and I'm on staff with the Minnesota School Boards Association. And with us today, you have two outstanding individuals from our Management Service Division at the Minnesota School Boards Association. They will be taking you through the process of collective bargaining and giving you, bringing you the members up to date on some of the settlements and where they're at. And so rather than me go on, I would just turn this over to Gary Lee on my far right, and Amy Fullenkamp Taylor in the middle here will take you through the presentation.
Madam Chair.
Senator Tomasoni.
Just out of curiosity, why are we listening to this?
Why are we listening to this?
Yeah.
Well, because
I mean, what do we have to do with bargaining?
we have, pardon me? We end up having to fund the results. So
I know we provide the money, but I don't think we do any of the bargaining, do we?
No, we don't.
So why are we listening to this?
Well,
I'm just
you have a choice.
Oh, thank you. I better stick around then.
Okay, welcome.
Madam Chair and members, as Kirk mentioned, I'm Amy Taylor, and Gary and I will just kind of do a brief walkthrough of PELRA, the Public Employee Labor Relations Act, and then give you some information relative to where settlements have been coming in for this last round of negotiations. So on the first slide here is just our agenda. Basically, we're going to talk about PELRA highlights, teacher compensation, bargaining from a management perspective, MSBA's teacher salary summary report, and then, as I mentioned, results as of to date that MSBA has received. PELRA provides that employees have a legal right to organize into bargaining units. Those that are organized into bargaining units, the employer and the employee groups are required to meet and negotiate. As a result of that negotiation, those items need to be listed out into written agreements. And PELRA also provides for establishing procedures and limits regarding the bargaining process. So there's parameters placed around the process that the employee groups and the employer must follow. Some key definitions relative to bargaining would be terms and condition of employment, and these items must be negotiated, and those items would include things as hours of employment, compensation, fringe benefits, etc. And then inherent managerial policy are items that do not need to be negotiated. And things that might be included in there are the employer's budget, utilization of technology, the selection and direction of personnel. And I should mention that MS-123B.02 subdivision 15 was amended and made the identity and number of 403B vendors a term and condition of employment. So going back to terms and condition employment, now employers and bargaining groups can negotiate the identity and number of 403B vendors. So that's not part of the definition of terms and conditions of employment, but because another statute was amended, it has now become a term and condition of employment.
Madam Chair?
Senator Bono.
Madam Chair, I didn't understand what you just said.
Thank you. I didn't either.
When units are recognized by the Bureau of Mediation Services and they go to bargain with the employer, there are certain things that have to be negotiated at the table. So hours of employment, their compensation. So what is our salary going to look like? And Gary is going to talk about teachers specifically and a salary schedule, and that's typically how teachers will be paid, and their compensation will be negotiated regarding a salary schedule, and then also fringe benefits. So what type of insurance?
Ms. Fullenkamp, I think she was referring to this additional thing that
thank
passed
you.
The
law.
The 403, I'm sorry. Oh,
we didn't understand what you were referring to.
Madam Chair, that's correct. That's what I didn't understand.
Thank you, Senator Bonner.
Member, thank you. Statute 123B.02 subdivision 15 talks about retirements, and within there it said that the available number of 403B vendors could now be an item of negotiation. It was now considered a term and condition of employment. So before then, the employer could establish what vendors were going to be available for the 403B, et cetera. But because, which is a retirement plan similar to a 401K in the private sector. So 403B would be similar to a 401K.
So they can bargain for those which vendors they want to be able
exactly.
to use for that.
And
okay.
within that statute 123B, there's a laundry list of things that they need to consider when they're identifying who those vendors will be.
Okay.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Pillar also states that the negotiations need to be public meetings. So if there's negotiations going on, mediation sessions, et cetera, those all need to be open to the public unless closed by the commissioner. So the Bureau of Mediation Services commissioner does reserve that right to close those meetings. Pelra also states that contracts are supposed to be for a specified period of time. Non-licensed, such as paras, bus drivers, et cetera, those contracts can range anywhere from 1 to 3 years, whereas teachers, the law specifically states that it has to be for a two-year period, and that's to begin on July 1 of each odd-numbered year. So currently, districts are in the process of negotiating the 2011-13 round if they've not previously settled. That's what they're bargaining right now.
Madam Chair. Senator Nelson. Thank you. I have a question on that two-year duration piece, and maybe it's later in your presentation, and that will be fine, but a number of my districts have talked about what they call continuing contracts. And so those items that were negotiated at one point continue on indefinitely. Is that correct, unless they're negotiated out?
So Ms. Mellencamp? Taylor?
Madam Chair and Senator, if I'm understanding your question correctly, so for example, I'll use health insurance. If they've negotiated a flat dollar amount of, say, $500, that amount would stay in place and the two parties would agree to a different amount.
Is that
Senator Nelson?
Madam Chair? So are contracts then continuing contracts, and are in order for something to change in the contracts, whether it be health insurance or something else, does it require negotiations in both parties to agree to? I'm just trying to get the overall view of this here.
Madam Chair, Gary Lee.
Thank you.
Senator, continuing contract simply states that at the end of the two-year period, that until the new contract is negotiated with new terms and new conditions and new rates of pay, it continues to operate. So that there isn't a stoppage of work on July 1st of a specific year. So we'll start into negotiations. We're in negotiations now with the various bargaining units, and we may change, you know, we may come to an agreement to make some changes, and that may or may not go back retroactively then to the beginning of this contract period. Does that answer your question?
Somewhat, yes.
Right.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Kelleher.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. We just
why recently, don't you say your name for the record? Because
thank you, Grace Kelleher, and I represent the Minnesota School Boards Association. My colleagues are doing a great job. They train all the school board members around the state and how this process works. Senator Perry had a bill up yesterday that talked about when a contract ends. And just to be specific, a contract's wages and benefits, even after the end date, continue for the employees until a new contract is negotiated. Present law also allows step and lanes to be given. So though they can move, that presently is provided. So I think your question is they continue to get pay and health benefits going forward when that contract ends. And I think that's
thank you.
Where your concern was coming from.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, it also says talks about a reopener clause. Again, for non-licensed paras, bus drivers, et cetera, they can reopen their agreements or contracts to renegotiate some terms and conditions within that. However, teachers, the law says that the teacher's compensation, including fringe benefits for the entire 2 year shall not contain a wage reopening clause for any provision for the renegotiation of the teacher's compensation. So basically, the parties are negotiating everything for that full 2 years at that point in time. There's not an opportunity to go back during that course of the agreement or contract to renegotiate something, whereas in the other groups, they have that option to go back and by mutual agreement to reopen and renegotiate something.
Madam Chair?
Senator Reeder.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question in general. Do you know how much is spent by management for negotiating the contracts, and if you have approximately 340 agreements, but what the expense would be? I assume there's outside counsel and it's used through district funds, but the collective amount throughout the state, and then I had a follow-up.
Ms. Bonk, oh.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Gary Lee. Lee. Yeah.
Mr. Lee.
Madam Chair, Senator, we don't track that specifically. As a total of administrative costs, generally through the whole process, for the whole school's school year budget, you're looking at about 8%, you know, of a total dollar amount. At least that's the last thing I looked at. But that's total administration. We don't specifically look at negotiations. If you're looking at smaller districts, will generally have school board members do a lot of the negotiations, and as you know, a lot of those people are volunteers for the most part, especially in the smaller districts. Larger districts will hire legal counsel and stuff, but we don't specifically, you know, analyze that information.
Okay. And Madam Chair, so there's a variety of approaches depending on the district. You know, we have a number of expectations, requirements that we have in place here at the state and for the students and for districts. Though we have any number of benefits or salary schedules throughout the state, does it make sense to have such a variety of salary schedules and benefits from one district to the next and realizing how much it costs? You know, your thoughts on that as it relates to regional bargaining or just, you know, the equity in having such a difference in benefit packages when we're looking at a variety of state expectations?
Mr. Lee.
Madam Chair, Senator, I'll get to some of that a little bit later on in our presentation, but generally I think the position of the association is that it goes back to local control and local involvement, and getting the local school board members involved with the process. I was a school board member for 6 years. I've been through the process in a small little district and negotiated with my friends many times, and we're still friends. And so I think we'll see from an association standpoint, we see that as a good thing. And there are definitely differences from where I'm from in Fertile, Minnesota, up by Leroy, Senator Stump, I'm sorry, Senator Stump area, and versus the metropolitan where my children first started going to school. So, but I'll address that a little bit more in a little more detail.
Thank you.
Okay, why don't you continue?
Okay.
Well, Camp Taylor?
On the next slide is just looking at a typical master agreement, again, if there is such a thing as a typical, because every district has a little bit different language. But when reviewing master agreements, et cetera, you will commonly see a definition of school districts, insurance, which will include health insurance, dental, life insurance, long-term disability, et cetera. You'll have a leave section, and that will include language regarding sick leave, emergency leave, bereavement leave, et cetera. And then some have discipline, and then you'll also see the seniority and unrequested leave of absence, which has to do with the process for reducing staff. With that said, then, I will turn over to my colleague, Gary Lee.
Mr. Lee.
Madam Chair, the first slide I'd like to introduce you to is a salary schedule. This is an actual schedule from one of our members, our 336 members that we have, and it is the foundation for how teachers are paid. Now, there has been changes here and there throughout the state at different school districts attempting to work with different methods of payment, and we encourage that. But this is generally how it's done now. And how it's laid out is by steps and lanes. And so going down on the grid is a step, which generally equates to a year of service. And going to the right is a lane, which equates to additional education by that teacher. So the first lane is a bachelor's of administration lane. The second lane would be a bachelor's plus 15 credits if you're on a quarter system, right? So this is a typical schedule, and it has 14 steps with 8 lanes. We down at the bottom, what has happened over the course of time is that they've negotiated career steps, which means when a teacher gets past their 14th year and they've hit the top or top of the schedule, now after, in this case, after they've, for their 15th through their 19th years of service, they'd move into another step, and they would stay there then for those 4 years, okay, or 5 years, right? And so that's basically the outline of a schedule. And please interrupt me as we're going through this. We're going to start getting to a little more technical stuff now. So if there's something you don't understand, we'll roll
Mr.
in.
Lee, is this pretty much uniform in terms of the large or small school districts using this particular construct, or is this just an example of one?
This is an example, Madam Chair. This is an example of the schedule. This is an exact one, and it's actually from Buffalo is where it's from. It's just one that I grabbed. You may see some that have only 8 steps,
okay,
and only 5 lanes across. I've seen some that have 26 to 30 steps, you know, and so they're all uniquely negotiated depending on the wants and the desires of both the school board and the bargaining unit at that location. So, on the next slide, we'll talk a little more about the schedules themselves. The majority, like I said, of the schools use this as the basis for their salaries. Steps then are the vertical movement down, and lanes are the horizontal movement across. And each school, like I said previously, uniquely negotiates their own schedules. We as an association do not promote a one-size-fits-all. We want you to sit down with your bargaining unit as members of MSBA and work out what makes sense for your district. All right. Also on schedules, and what we have seen because of that encouragement is we have some with career steps, like I said before, many steps, very few steps, many lanes, only one lane. I believe Hopkins has only one lane here in the metro area. And so there is, you know, they've done a lot of things, you know, at each locale to do something a little bit different.
So do you happen to know, Mr. Lee, of how long they've had that one lane, or was that an outgrowth of their becoming a QComp district?
No, that's been there for actually quite a while. Mm-hmm. And adding on the QComp would be something additional, Madam Chair.
Okay, so. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Senator Daley.
Madam Chair, thank you. Sir, I see a second bullet up there. It says MSBA provides a clearinghouse function for members to compare master agreements and schedules. How does a member of the public get a copy of salary schedules, contracts, and benefits from an individual school district?
Madam Chair, Madam Chair, Senator, that would be through your individual school district. We serve our members, and so the information that we have is not necessarily, it's public as far as that school district is concerned, but when we have the information, it's for our members. And so you can go to that school district and say, can I see your schedule? Can I see your contract that you have with your teachers? Could you provide a copy of that for me as a constituent of your school district?
Do you find that, Madam Chair?
Senator Daley.
Do you find that that's typically published anywhere, or is it something that you have to specifically ask for?
Madam Chair, Senator, you would have to ask for that. Publishing it, it's like any legal document. They can be up to 60 pages long, and really nobody wants to read them. And so if you wanted to look at the schedules and look at that information, generally we don't see the public asking for that information up front. They want to know the bottom line, what's being paid out. So,
Madam Chair.
Senator Rieger.
Madam Chair, my experience is that most school districts' websites will show each of the collective bargaining agreements.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to continue.
In addition, Madam Chair, in addition to the pay of the based on the schedule, teachers can get additional pay via Q Comp, which you're well aware of. Also, through extracurricular or co-curricular activities, whether they're coaching or working with the speech team or debate team or whatever the extra activities are. And then in some cases, we'll see in the master agreements or the contracts that the individual teachers, that the full-time teachers that belong to that unit, sometimes pick up some substitute classes. If they're in the science department and a science teacher is missing for a specific day, they'll pick up during their prep time hours, they'll pick up some additional classes then, which works out well because you have a teacher within the school district who knows the students and can fill that role for substitute. We also have, as far as compensation, leaves. Now, you may say that that's a non-financial benefit, but as far as a school district is concerned, it does cost the district. It is a cost when a teacher is not in the classroom because a substitute has to be in that room in order to direct the class. So we have leaves are, I'll get to more about leaves here on the next slide. And then we have benefits that also apply, and that's generally your insurances and retirements is what those two are. Now, from a management perspective, when we do bargaining, the first thing that comes up generally is fund balances. The statement of position by the Office of the State Auditor this year, December of 2010, she put it out, recommended that local governments maintain an unrestricted fund balance in their general fund and special revenue funds of approximately 35% to 50% of their operating revenues or no less than 5 months worth of expenditures. I don't know if there are any school districts in this state that have 35% to 50%. It's a very small number. Generally, the last I looked at the fund balances, we have as of 2010, we have $1.2 billion in fund balances in our schools, and that represents totally less than 25% of the school's annual expenditures. So in general, fund balances, what we encourage our school districts and school boards to do is use fund balances to get through the shift and get through various times where payments from the state are lower than others. So when property taxes aren't coming in, we use that as your cash flow. That's what it's meant to be used for. And we look at that as just wise management, to have a fund balance that's going to get you from point A to point B without having to borrow money. What we do encourage our members to do is to bargain based on our projected revenue. What are the students that are coming into your district, and what is the revenue that's coming in on state aid and in property taxes? That's what you should sit down and bargain with when you're dealing with your employees. From a leave standpoint, leaves in the past were easy to negotiate into contracts when there was very little money for teachers. And so it was easy to say to a teacher, say, how about if we give you an extra day off? We'll give you an extra personal day. Well, as we march down this road, it's readily apparent that whenever a teacher is not in the classroom, it's impacting our students. And school boards know better than anyone that the most important resource we have is our teachers. And so we need to have our teachers in those rooms. So having put those leaves into our contracts, it's kind of difficult to get them back out again. And so from a leave standpoint, that's one thing that we encourage our members to do, is look at the leaves. We have a fixed day contract with our bargaining units. We would like to have those teachers in the classroom teaching and not bringing substitutes in. The next one is the one that we hear the most squawking about, and that is dollars versus percentages. Everyone wants to know what the percentage is that we have given our given teachers on an annual basis. Well, we don't pay teachers in percentages. We pay them in dollars. And whenever my background is in accounting, and I used to work for a large defense company, it was early on that we quit using percentages. That was here in the metro area. Percentages can be manipulated any which way you want them to. You do not, a percentage is a calculation that you do not know what the basis is of it. You don't know what the two numbers, at least two numbers, maybe three or four numbers are used in order to come up with that calculation. For an example, I just had a request this last week, and I mentioned it earlier, that someone in this institution had asked for what is the administrative cost in school districts. And so what I provided was a pie chart that stated 8%. But that was just public schools. So then what I did, just out of curiosity, I just put the charter school information in with that. And the number went up to 8.5%. So what does that tell me? The first thing I thought was charter schools are spending too much money on administration. The second thought was maybe charter schools have less costs in general, which makes their administrative costs higher. You don't know. I tell you 8.5%. You have nothing to base that on. What you need are the real numbers. And so MSBA, once in a while, it'll slip, and we'll say percentages. But in generally our foundation here now is that we'll always talk in dollars, because that's what we pay, and that's what we use. That's what you provide us as dollars, and we provide the teachers as dollars. Questions, so we'll move along. The last thing is total cost. We want our school districts to look at the bottom line. On occasion, you know, you can look that there are a few districts out there that are in statutory operating debt. It's not very many. We're down to a real small number. But it's because, generally, they're not looking at that total cost and that bottom line to make sure that they're staying afloat. If they're not staying afloat, we're not doing our students or our teachers any good. So now what we request, what we provide our school board members is a form, a summarization sheet that we encourage them to use when they're in negotiations. And I don't want you to try and memorize this or really look at it at all, other than we try to provide an apples-to-apples comparison so that we'll start with the full-time equivalent of teachers at the end of a contract period, and we'll use that same amount through the whole negotiation process. We'll ask what your total dollars are based, as you can see on our form, of these various types of costs. It's scheduled costs, Q comp, health insurance, life insurance, all these different factors. And we'll ask what your dollars are. And then when you're negotiating, use this sheet to cost out what the how much it's going to cost you on the bottom line. And when you're done, send us the report so that we can compile it for you, and you can look at what your neighboring districts or districts of your same size and same characteristics are paying. We also collect additional information on this. The problem we have with this is it's not mandated. This is voluntary information. And so, as we'll see later, there can be a 4-month or 5-month lag by the time they ratify it and by the time we get the information. And there's the second sheet. To date, talk a little bit about the results so far.
Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson.
I just have one question on this form, which I can see is very valuable. I think people would like to know that. Are you suggesting that it be mandatory? You said it's voluntary. It's not mandatory. I'd like your thoughts on that.
Madam Chair, Senator, absolutely not.
Okay, you're saying you as an organization don't mandate that they give it to you.
Madam Chair and Senator, we strongly recommend that they provide it to us. We'll have 300 of the 336 members we have last go around, we had 326 responses. We get a good enough response to understand what we need. All right. So the data is good. Right? It's not, it doesn't match up in total, but it's good information.
Thank you.
Okay. So using that information, being the accountant that I am, we start throwing that information together and pulling out in many different ways. For this presentation, what I've done on this chart is to segregate between schedule costs and non-schedule costs. So the schedule costs are in blue. This is the increase. This is the increase for 2 years as a result of a settlement. So you can see in 2011-13, the schedule costs are coming in lower than the average. 2009-2011 were a little bit lower. They were at $3,000 per FTE or per teacher over the course of a two-year period. And right now, with 143 districts reporting, we're a little over $3,000. Okay. So right now, the members, you know, they've been providing a little bit more than they did the last time, but in general, they're holding the line as compared to the last seven contract periods. Then in the non-scheduled costs, what I'd like to show you on the next slide, I took those non-scheduled costs and I broke them out into insurance, retirement, and other. Other would include Q comp, one-time payments, things like that. As you can see, in the middle of the first decade, we had a lot of high insurance costs. But for this go-around, you can see that our insurance costs are under increases. This is the two-year increase again, is under $500 per teacher, per FTE. But our retirement has caught us a little off guard, and that's almost $1,000 per FTE, which has to do with the increase in the TRA. And that's where that has come from, which is a mandated amount.
Can you just interpret here, when you say schedule or non-schedule, the steps and lanes that we were talking about, are they in the schedule?
That's the schedule, Madam Chair. That is
the schedule.
That would be steps and lanes and increases.
Increases with it that are negotiated.
Yes, that are negotiated. So there's three components there. There is the schedule as it sits today, and a teacher coming the next year will move one step down, so they'll get an increase from the step. If they've taken other approved classes, and generally most contracts require that as they're moving in the lanes, their classes have to be germane to what they're teaching and be approved prior by administration, so they can have an increase going horizontally. And if we, across the board, increase each one of those cells on there by a dollar amount, which we'd encourage that, then that would be a third way to get an increase on the schedule.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Daley.
Sir, if you go back one slide, looking at the different columns, what does this mean? The second column is a little bit lower than the first one. The first one's $6,000. Is that dollars?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator, that is $6,000 per FTE. Full-time equivalent.
So nearly $6,000, not quite, in the second column. So is that almost $6,000 above and beyond what was the prior year?
Madam Chair, Senator, that is correct. But that is our cost. That is not take-home to the teachers. That is our cost. That is the school district's cost. It includes our contribution to the TRA. It includes our FICA costs. It includes our contribution to health insurance, not the teacher's health contribution. It's just strictly our cost.
So cumulatively, if you were to add these up, your costs are almost, on average, $6,000 per year.
Per 2 years.
Or additive. Every 2 years, you're adding almost $6,000 for the period 1999 through 2009, and then between $4,000 and $5,000 additional monies those 2 year periods on top of all the previous additions.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator, it is a attitude. This is, we're looking at what we've negotiated for cost in each 2 year period. Yeah, that is correct.
So if I were to do some quick math, being the good accounting person that you are and I are, maybe we can do this together. The first five columns show approximately $30,000 per individual, plus between four and five, so $39,000 additional per person over that period of time.
Madam Chair, Senator, but you have to remember it's a 2 year cost. It's not, we're not stacking. They'll get $3,000 1 year, $3,000 the second year, okay? And so they're not taking home $3,000. It's our cost, okay, which is a lot different.
But the cost is for the 2 year period, not for each year of the period.
Madam Chair, that is correct. That is the cost that we will incur during that 2 year period. Madam Chair, we have someone else sitting at our table here. He is one of our mentors. All right. And his name is Bob Lowe.
Bob Lowe.
And he has something.
Hey, welcome, Mr. Lowe. Your name
you.
For the record. And
yes, my name is Bob Lowe. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to
clarify. You are what connection?
I'm in the Management Services Division with the Minnesota School Boards Association as well.
Okay.
To clarify a little bit, I think the committee needs to understand that the figures that we use include all costs to a settlement. We include the costs not only of the salary increases, any insurance or other benefit increases, cost, for example, for an additional day of personal leave. We include that in. Lane changes, insurance increases, increases, for example, in TRA. As you know, TRA's costs went up 0.5%. per teacher and per employee each of the next 4 years, that cost was included in. So all costs are included in MSBA's reporting forms. That's how we figure school districts can operate on a year-to-year basis. There's a difference between the reporting of our costs and the reporting of settlements, as you commonly will see in newspapers or as reported by Education Minnesota and other units, and that is they generally report increases in salaries and benefits, not total costs. So as you look, you will see different figures and you will see different numbers. Remember, though, that ours includes all costs from the base year through the next 2 years.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, question?
Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you address the decrease? It looks like 2007-2009 time period compared to the 2009-2011 was a significant decrease, and then slightly going back the other direction. Can you address that?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator.
Lee.
It's a decrease in the increase.
All right. Thank you.
We're just looking at the increase here. All right, the change.
It didn't increase as much.
Exactly, Senator. Yep.
Madam Chair, just a note. It was a pretty dramatic, not different, you know, if you look at the rest of the time, and then that was pretty
Madam Chair, Senator, it has to do with encouraging our districts to look at what their revenue is going to be, and they have to balance that bottom line is what it boils down to.
That's kind of like they froze Social Security for two or three years. Yeah. And some of those things I think you've tried to negotiate. Sometimes it was soft. There may have been a few hard freezes. But
that's correct.
Okay.
Sir, just, Madam Chair.
Senator Daley.
Just one final confirmation of the conclusion of this. One can take away that at a minimum, costs per teacher per two-year period in every period has exceeded $4,000 per teacher over these seven periods.
Madam Chair, Senator, that's correct. last, Madam Chair, to continue, on this slide here, we're putting some dollar figures together, and we've broken it out by the size of the district. And so you have in 2011-13, we'll show then that for the smallest districts, the ones that have 1 to 25 teachers, so far the schedule has improved over the course of those 2 years, $1,760. Benefits have went up $738, and the other costs have went up $96. So what we've looked, you know, if we look statewide at the bottom, the average district cost, additional cost so far, per teacher is $3,800. When we go over to the 14-year average, now we're looking at, we're below that average of 4564. So.
Okay.
All right. Now you
Senator
can.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You speak about the cost and the change in the year figure that we have. It's considerably low for 2009 to 2013. So could you tell us, when you say, when you put these dollars of 3,800, 4,500 in terms of additional cost, if I want to extract out of that what the teacher takes home, could you tell me what that number is?
Madam Chair, Senator, that would be, we haven't attempted that. And it has to do a lot with the size, you know, that individual teacher's family, what their tax situation is. It has to do with a lot of different things. And so you could start with, if you looked at the schedule amount, the scheduled dollar amount, so that would be an increase to their starting gross pay. That those additional dollars are actually going onto their gross pay. But there's withholdings, and there's with all these other things that add into it. And so it would be a stab in the dark at this point without doing some real analysis on that.
Madam Chair,
Senator Torres-Ray.
I presume you have some idea.
Okay.
It can be that you, out of the four, so you calculate to the point of 3,800, it has to be at least a percentage, at least in the last few years, because I understand that then the salary take out of that cost, if we look at the negotiations that have taken place, is zero. Salaries have not gone up. So the cost is associated with benefits and retirement only.
Madam Chair, Senator, the schedules have went up. You know, it depends on how the reporting is done also. We look at all increases, and you would, and my friend Lee Johansson back here would say that they don't look, from Ed, Minnesota, they don't look at those automatic step increases as a raise in salary. All right, and that's just our difference of opinion. Right, so we look at what we paid in costs at 1 year and what we pay the next year. I brought Lee to the front.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Cruz, I think, had his hand up here first, and then I'll come to you, Senator Daley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just kind of a real quick follow-up to that. I guess I'm a little bit concerned about the terminology that we're using here when we start describing these as not going to the teachers. So I guess my question would be, you know, we look at these increases, and my question is twofold. First, are any of these increases, these costs, we're calling them costs, that's fine, but I want to make sure we're talking about what we're talking about here. Are any of these costs going to our school children? Or are all of these costs related to benefits that are being received by our teachers?
Madam Chair, Senator, this has to do with the settlement. This is not about buying books. This is about the contract, the master agreement with the union. That's what it's about. Does that answer your question?
That's all that's a part of this class.
Well, I think. Thank you, Madam Chair.
If you think that if you believe that the teacher is important as a part of the contribution to serving the students, then you have to say it's for the students. But it's the costs that they're talking about are just as it relates to contract agreements.
Right, and I think, Madam Chair, that's my point here, and I agree with you. I think probably teachers are the most important piece of our education system. I think we've proven that, and that's why we've made steps this year to make sure that we have the most effective teachers possible in the classrooms, because we acknowledge that teachers are the most important part of education. I would say second only to the family. I think you have to have a family backing that up that is substantial. But I want to make sure that we understand, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, but these all have to do with benefits that are ultimately going back to the teachers, whether it be benefits through health insurance, benefit through retirement packages, whatever those may be. These are contributions that the districts and we as a state are making on their behalf to set them up. If this was somebody that was in a private industry that had to self-insure or do other things, these are all costs that would ultimately fall on them. So for that reason, I would qualify this as a benefit. This is a benefit that's going to the teachers. So I want to make sure we're using the right terminology here.
we are getting information as to how that system of salary and benefits and the negotiation for it works. That's all this is an overview of what is. So it's not to critique it, it's to see what is, and that's what they're presenting to us today.
Madam Chair.
Senator Daley, did you have another question before we...
I thought I might have heard him correctly, but I wasn't sure. Sir, did you say that a step increase was not considered an increase?
Mr. Lee?
Madam Chair, Senator, we consider it an increase. It is considered an increase in our costs. Yes.
Mr. Lowe?
But not everyone does that.
And why wouldn't, Madam Chair?
Senator Daley.
Why wouldn't everyone do that?
Madam Chair, Senator, you'll have to ask the union why they wouldn't do that. I don't know. They look at that as being something that's already been negotiated, that annual increase, and that's part of the deal. So that really is out of my realm. So,
Madam Chair.
Senator Thomasoni.
Senator Daley's as confused as I am. Maybe we should get Minnesota Public or the teachers union up here also to respond to that.
Well, I'm sure if they're squirming enough, we'll let them say something. Mr. Lowe, why don't you?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. These numbers are very confusing, but I think it's clear and it's fair to say that these numbers, based on the settlement results, are the actual costs of retaining the teachers in the positions they hold. Yes, it's TRA's costs are both the school districts and the employees, but those are actual costs to one or the other party, and that's the numbers that we use in our reporting forms. I think in answer to your question, Madam Chair, may I?
Mr. Lowe.
In answer to your previous question, Senator, the generally employee groups will look at bargained benefits and or salary as previously bargained. Therefore, when they bargain for new or increased salaries and or benefits, they consider them raises. That's general. I think we see that across most labor groups. Obviously, we see it somewhat differently, and we calculate it somewhat differently. That's why our numbers and their numbers don't always agree.
Okay. You've only got a couple slides left. Why don't we finish up, and then we'll We'll let you have a say your piece.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Mr.
Wade. The next slide just shows how settlements are coming in without the January 15th date in place. It shows that the top four, all just followed the date, and that's when we got our settlements done by January 15th. That's when they were reported to us. That doesn't necessarily mean we had good settlements, but they were done, so we weren't penalized. The two periods that we had previously, you can see kind of follow that general 45-degree angle on the way up and just kind of roll along, and they get it done. Eventually, they get it done. And you can see that right now, this year, we have a tail that's starting to drag down, but that tail has been there since October, and it just continues to move up because the reporting comes into us 3 to 4 months late sometimes. The last 10 reports that we received had four from October and December. So that tail is going to be there until we get through this whole process. And the last thing that I'll say in conclusion is all our bargaining is defined by statutes and case law. And that's what controls our process and the content of our negotiations. The process is not perfect. I've sat through it myself, but it works. And it provides, as Senator Wieger said earlier, wondering about regional, it provides some local ownership and the local constituents and parents' involvement in what's going on in that school. And we believe as an association that local control is the right way to go. And that's why we think it's okay. We understand the arguments on the other side. So like I said, this is not perfect, but it works. And then all the data, whether it's our data or anybody else's, can be manipulated. And you just have to make sure that when you look at it, you're looking at the raw basic data and you ask the right questions. And we would be glad to give you more data if you want more data. You just have to ask. So, and that's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator Zeebman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if the testifiers have any comments on whether they think that there's been stable and fair funding for the public schools that you represent, for the school districts. I know that your presentation is not on this, but I think that your presentation is probably teeing up the committee for possibly an amendment on the next bill related to some other attack on our public teachers. And I just am curious if you had any comments on whether you think that this committee and, in effect, the state has provided fair and stable funding for the school districts.
Madam Chair, I think what we would do from our standpoint is not comment on that, but rather have Grace or Kirk comment on that. And it's not the area that neither Amy or I work in. So we thank you for your time. If there's no other questions, we'll pull back.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your work. Ms. Kelleher.
Madam Chairman, Grace Kelleher with the School Boards Association, Senator Zeebman. We aren't involved. These folks right here next to me, these three folks, work in St. Peter helping school boards understand what the state law means out there. They don't participate in any of the political activity or any of the coming and goings. We brought you the real folks who go out and talk to folks. So if they don't have the perfect answer or the politically correct statement constantly, they go out and do hard work every day to help school boards across the state help their communities and their teachers come to solutions for kids.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Zeebman,
Ms. Kelleher, could you comment then on whether you think the legislature in the state is providing fair and adequate funding for our school districts then, if you're the lobbyist representing the School Board Association?
Ms. Kelleher.
Madam Chairman, our delegate assembly has picked it up, which really gives our association their lobbying. They're called the Pink Sheets. And on that, we don't believe we have achieved equitable or stable funding for the school children of the state.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members.
Sir, you. Ms. Trostry?
If I may ask the testifiers to please leave your presentation. I have some questions that I think it will be important to have. I think your presentation was great. And I would like to have Education Minnesota come and present, but I would like to do it in the context of your presentation because you're the administrators. So I'd like to hear the teacher side of this presentation, but it would be easier if we could have some of the information in front of us, if you don't mind.
Well, we do have the whole...
Well, that's true. We can use this. Yeah, that's fine. That's true.
Who's first? Who's on first?
I guess I'm on first. My name is Lee Johansson. I am the negotiation specialist with Education Minnesota. The first teacher contract I bargained was in 1981, and I've been bargaining teacher contracts in every two-year cycle since that time. I shudder to think of how many mediation sessions and bargaining sessions I've sat through. I've been engaged in discussions and costing.
You've earned the gray hair, just as that, I have.
And yes. It's coming in quite nicely now. Thank you. We have always, during that time, had discussions and debates about costing schedules and costing settlements. And one of the reasons that it's not something that seems as or that is as cut and dried as it seems is that the best you can do is take a snapshot in time, because it's a moving target. For instance, all of the numbers that you heard just previously were based on a myth. And that myth is that the people who were employed, for instance, this year, the people who were employed in 2009, 2010, will stay the exact same employee set that's in place for 2010, 2011, and then again for 2011, 2012. We know that that never happens. As a matter of fact, a few years ago, I did a study of settlement reports from a school district in southeastern Minnesota, a substantial one, using the school district's costing and comparing what they projected the costs would be 2 years in the second year of the contract to 2 years later when they showed what their actual cost had been. Every one of those reports was at least 1.5% projected higher than what the actual cost was. In some cases, it was much as 2.2% higher than the actual cost what is. But that's okay, because it's really a tool that allows us to freeze the field so that when we're talking salary schedules, which is what we negotiate and what goes into the contract, we have a common understanding of what its impact might be. But it doesn't project the cost. The other thing that happens is... You know, if we look and say, well, what happened? Senator Torres Ray asked about how much salaries had gone up. Well, I have a document here that shows that the average teacher salary in 2009-10 was $52,431.
But I think, wasn't she also asking how much they take home?
Yeah.
And that was the hard part.
Yeah, this is the actual salary, however. This isn't...
That's the gross salary.
This is not fringe benefits. This is not cost of taxation. This is just what the salary is. What they take home is obviously very difficult because...
But the actual salary would be their gross salary that from which taxes are withheld and other things that...
The taxable portion of their compensation. So salary, if they are coached, that would be added into it.
Yeah.
Those taxable portions of their compensation. But at any rate, my point is, in 2010-2011, it went up to $53,628, about a $1,200 increase. But, you know, averages are kind of interesting things, because you know what really caused that average to go up? The massive layoffs that occurred during that year, because we laid off 5,000 teachers.
The low end.
And they're at the lower end of the scale. So without any negotiated pay increase, that average salary jumps 2.4%. And so it's a pretty slippery slope when you try to actually say that these numbers are real. Mm-hmm. So with that said, there's a couple of points that I'd like to make. I did hear that the state auditor has recommended that school districts have 30 to 50% fund balances. It's my understanding, and I didn't study it deeply, but I did look at it close enough to understand, that recommendation was for cities and counties that have a completely different cash flow than what school districts have, and it didn't have any bearing on school districts whatsoever. But with that said, we believe that school districts have to be managed financially soundly. We believe that, in fact, they serve as a bank for you guys. When you guys needed $1 billion last year, their fund balances were very nice, and you borrowed from them, and that worked out pretty well for you.
Let me stop you. Did you say the legislative auditor or the state auditor?
I believe it's the state auditor.
State auditor said that they
should report, have 30. The quote is from the MSBA that the state auditor had recommended these kind of fund balance, 30 to 50%. It's my understanding, and I've looked pretty closely, that there has been no recommendation from the state auditor specific to school districts. You know, if you stop and think, a city or a county on July 1, the start of the new fiscal year, you know, the new taxes don't come in until October, you know, so there's a whole different cash flow that goes into play there. It's okay if you say that dollars are what's real and percents aren't. But, you know, when inflation is measured in a percent, maybe cost of living should be measured in a percent as well. It's an apples-to-apples comparison. Now getting to the point where the characterization of how we – and I'm sorry, Senator Daley has left, because the fact is that a completely inaccurate statement was made about how we cost salaries. We cost salaries including the steps and, in many cases, including the lanes, depending on what was bargained. What we report to the general public is we report what the salary schedule improvement was. That's what the salary schedule went up. And what, there are several reasons why that's the number that we report. We report that number because then it's an apples-to-apples comparison. Because District A might have a very senior staff with really nobody taking steps or lanes, or very few. They've already maxed out on the schedule. District B might have a junior staff with many people advancing through the schedule. And if you then take what the compensation cost is and try to compare that as being an apples-to-apples comparison, it's really not. Now, when we cost schedules at the bargaining table, we include all of those costs. We don't have any problem with that. But we just don't think it's a useful number to throw out there to give people a comparison. That schedule improvement is really what is a useful number for comparison purposes. We find it interesting that I think, and I don't want to put words in Bob Lowe's mouth, so if I'm wrong, Bob, tell me, and I'm sure he will. I think he said that when they costed the TRA increase, for instance, there was a 5%, half a percent increase for both the employer and the employee, and he counted that as part of that cost. Is that correct for both the employer and the employee? No, that's okay. Then I misunderstood you. Because what we have to remember is if cost went up a half a percent for the employer, part of that salary increase that's bargained, that compensation increase, is not going to go to the teacher, but it's going to go to pay for the employee's share of that increase that the legislature put onto TRA. And we aren't commenting on whether that's wise or not. We think solid pension plans are very important, so we aren't being critical of that, but it's just, in fact, a cost that comes into play there. The question with regard to the continuing contract, as a matter of fact, every contract, every word of every contract is renegotiable every 2 years. And generally speaking, what the practices of the parties do is when they come to the table, they say, we like what's in the contract, except let's set aside these issues to study further. And so if one of these components is something that needs to be changed or adjusted, it's set aside, and then those are the issues that we're going to look at. But there isn't anything in that contract that's sacrosanct, that's not subject to collective bargaining. Now, then the question is, if we don't get collective bargaining done in a timely fashion, if July 1 comes or September 1 when the next school year comes, how do we compensate those people in the event that the new contract isn't settled? And I might point out that we would love to settle contracts before school's out in the spring. There are a couple of stumbling blocks, however. One is often the legislature has not done its job in terms of passing a school funding bill, and so the employer is reluctant to commit any financial resources without knowing what that funding bill is going to look like. And so meaningful bargaining is very difficult until sometime after the legislature has done that, and traditionally that's one of those last bills that sits there to get passed. So we're looking at June, and by the time those numbers get crunched and people can do an evaluation of what they mean for each district, you're going to be past that July 1st expiration date of that collective bargaining agreement anyway. And then another stumbling block comes in the way. Over the years, districts have been more and more reluctant to bargain until after their audit reports are in. And their audit reports used to come in late September, and now many of them aren't getting there until November. And it's very difficult, and again, districts wanting to be responsible are going to say, we don't want to commit until we know what our financial picture looks like. And so to continue the compensation and benefits as they were in the old contract makes sense, because structurally we've got things a little bit out of sync. You know, structurally we have a contract that expires on the 1st of July or on the 30th of June, and we don't have all of the pieces that many people think are necessary in order to know what to bargain for the next contract in place until the fall. And people are going to be starting work, and they have to get paid. So we think that continuing contract is it's a orderly way of doing business. And as was stated by the MSBA people, every provision of that contract is subject to negotiations, and some of them may agree that the pay will be retroactive back to the first of the year. In some cases, that's not the case. In some cases, it's bargained that the pay is effective from the date of ratification. But that's a subject of local negotiations, and the local parties will determine how to deal with that. And we think that it works relatively well. In terms of settlement reports, when we cost a salary schedule for bargaining purposes at the table, when we're exchanging information, we include what the cost of the steps are. Many places include what the cost of the lanes are. Some places do not, because they have a local agreement that it's a wash with other changes in cost. If they choose to include that, that's perfectly okay with us. We include schedule improvement. We include any increase in fringe benefits, whether it's health insurance, life insurance, long-term disability insurance. We sometimes quibble when the school district wants to charge any increases in workers' comp insurance against our package. We kind of think that that's getting a little bit fussy, but in the end, it's in there in many of them. And we include any extracurricular costs that are bargained, any coaches or speech coaches or whatever, pretty much the same as what MSBA indicated. Any department head stipends. We do not put in the cost of things that we don't bargain for. And so the cost of a substitute, we can't bargain for. A day-to-day substitute is not a public employee, and we are forbidden by law to bargain for them. And so we do not include the cost of day-to-day substitutes in our proposals. But other than that, it's a misnomer to say that we skip a significant cost center in our collective bargaining. So with that, if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. I think my colleague, Ms. Altweiger, would like to say a word or two.
Yeah, who was first, Bonhoff or Torres Ray?
No, I wasn't. I'm good.
But Senator Bonhoff.
Madam Chair, Mr. Johansson, one thing that I don't see in here and I haven't heard much about is starting salaries. Do you negotiate the starting salary, and how has then the starting salaries changed over time?
Well, the starting salary on the grid, if you looked at the grid, the upper left-hand corner is the starting salary for most teachers. Now, some people enter the profession.
Right, but it doesn't show by year-over-year starting
salary. No, we have data where we could draw that out of. We have, you know, computer programs where we can look at that. I know that last year the starting salary for a school teacher in Minnesota was somewhere around $33,000. Oh, but I don't have that
asking,
in this report.
Is that locally negotiated, the starting salary, and can you it seems like the starting salary over time has changed less than in other professions?
Starting salary is totally locally negotiated. And most of the time,
add in that the negotiators are at the upper end of the
scale? Well, but what we do is we improve the schedule. We say, you know, we're going to improve the schedule by, and we often like percents, so let's just say by a percent, or by, let me be a dreamer and say by 4%. And then that would be applied to every cell, including
the starter.
The starter.
Thank
cell.
You.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Johansson, it would be
helpful for me to get in simple terms, because I think Senator Tomassoni had a very good point. You know, negotiating this is tough, and we, you know, to what extent we need to know the detail to be at the table, I don't know. Our obligation is to make sure that, you know, we provide the resources so that our teachers are paid fairly. That's our job. So what I know is that Minnesota went from being, I believe, 8 to being 22 or something like that, 21, nationally, because on average, teachers' salaries have gone down about $2,500 at all levels. So what I want to understand, and that's what I wanted to ask the administrators. So the administrators had a chart that says the cost went up about $4,000. Then you hear the national, you know, kind of statistics say Minnesota went down to 21 from being 9. And so we need to present kind of the real picture in simple terms. Mm-hmm. And the real picture in simple terms is salaries have not increased. The cost of our system has gone up. And I think, you know, Senator Cruz was kind of getting at that. So if I today consider my salary and my benefits went up considerably, I don't take that money home. I'm more expensive. I'm more expensive because I cost more because of the office or whatever it is that, you know, comes with me. But teachers that come to me are telling me that they're reconsidering their profession because of this, because salaries are going down. So to me, that's the bottom line, right? So if benefits are going up, if all of these, you know, retirement costs are going up or anything, teachers at the end of the day, you know, well, their benefits, their health care is costing more. But they're not taking money home as a result of it. We're paying more. So help us understand from your perspective, is that correct? Because it seems to me that in reality, if I understand this correctly, the cost of paying for teachers is going up. We put 4,000, but we needed about 8, right, in order to really compensate a teacher. I want to compensate teachers. I really do. I think that they...
Can you let's so close up the question so we can get the answer, because we do need to move on. Thank you, Senator.
I wanted to be clear on my question.
Yes.
So I know. A very complicated answer.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Torres-Ray, I think that the simplest way to concur with your conclusion, I think, is in 1999-2000, the average teacher salary in Minnesota was $2,005, lower than the national average. And in 2010-11, it's $1,943, lower than the national average. So I guess we gained $58 on the process.
Now you're talking averages and percentages, but I mean, did people actually get – now I know my take-home pay has gone down for a number of years here. So I understand what that is,
sure.
But is that actually happening in reality, that their paychecks are getting smaller rather than staying, you know, even?
Madam Chair, that happens in many places where insurance contributions have gone up, or excuse me, premiums have gone up, but mm-hmm. employer contributions haven't gone up in amount. That comes out of the employee's compensation, and it goes down. For a teacher who is at the top of the schedule and isn't getting a step, oftentimes steps are all that's in a bargain these days. And so their salary stays the same, but their contribution towards benefits and what have you goes up. So their take-home pay is lower. So that happens in many cases.
Is there any other questions? Jan? Ms.
Allswiger,
sorry.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jan Allswiger, Education Minnesota. We were actually kind of surprised that we're having a discussion about collective bargaining, and really, with all due respect, the only one party is brought to the table to share the information, and we did not even get a copy of the presentation, so I feel like we're kind of reacting.
Aren't there extras out there?
No, Madam Chair.
So we can correct that.
You know, if you ever want to have a conversation in the future, we'd be more than happy to have a discussion so that we're less reactive and we can be more proactive and work with the School Boards Association like we like to do at the local level. When I was working on a contract, we, and many of our districts do this, they have collaborative bargaining, interest-based bargaining, and we didn't have an opportunity to talk about that, where in a school district, if you have an issue related to student achievement, where the teachers and the school boards would list all of their interests, all of their needs, and problem solve to try to get to that solution. And so that's something we maybe could have talked about. But and there are a whole lot of historical things that, such as in 1985, approximately in the mid-80s, at one time, the money came straight from the state to TRA. It didn't go to the school district, and the school district didn't report it, so that wasn't counted in our increases. And when people negotiate class sizes, those class sizes are often costed against us. So if we're trying to get the class sizes down to a lower level, that's often costed in the contract for us. But I just want to ask you a question. Do we really think, does anybody think, that teachers are paid too much? Do you know that in areas of this Minnesota, teachers don't even make $50,000. They make $48,000, $46,000 after 30 years. That doesn't only affect their living while they're in their career. It affects their pension for years. We would like to have policies in place where we're actually attracting and retaining teachers. And it is, as some of you have said, the costs are going up. Health insurance, most of our teachers would be thrilled to have the health insurance that you have. But instead, they pay more for their health insurance and have fewer benefits or lesser benefits than you do. The next year, in this round of bargaining, because of the pension contribution that was increased by 0.5%, because we have a 2% increase over the next four years, including this year, if the teachers freeze their salary, the school board report will say they got a 0.5% increase. And so over 2 years, if they freeze their salary, it will look like they got a 1% increase. And if you look at those 4 years, it will look like they got a 2% increase because that pension increase that the employer is paying is costed against the teacher. There are so many figures that we would ask you to think about. And the bottom line is, how are we going to attract and retain our teachers? Collective bargaining is not the problem. Our problem right now is that we have a lack of funding. And we are ready to sit at the table and collaborate with anybody, the school boards, the principals, Democrats, Republicans, Education Committee, other committees, to try to figure out how we can have enough money for kids so that we have good class sizes and good programs for our kids.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I would have to say that I don't think, I think we tend to try to simplify that it's just a matter of either money. I think we have a greater or collective bargaining. I don't have a problem with having collective bargaining. And the funding part, obviously, we have a challenge because we've got, if you look at our economy, it's become global instead of just state. And we've got just a lot of other demographics that are changing the competition for what the state share of it is. But I think a bigger challenge is we have got an entrenched system that is hard to change. And I think we're going to have to find a way to do things differently so that some of the expenses, we want money going into the classroom, but there are things that we are doing, even with our own regulations and things that are tying up a lot of resources that are not necessarily getting to that. And I think that that's going to be a continuing challenge if we're going to keep a system sustainable. Because I'm afraid right now we're having some difficult areas in that area. And I don't know where all the money is going to come from in order to sustain some of the costs, that burdens that the school districts have to bear. So, we may be approaching it from a little different, perspective or way, but we do have some challenges ahead. I won't be here to stir in those, but it's been an interesting challenge to see if we can't you know, keep it going and become solid, and that we continue to have a system we can be proud of. Senator Wolf, I think you had asked to be heard, and I apologize. I responded before recognizing you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I figured since we're going off on tangents, I'd just throw mine in there. And say that on behalf of many teachers, I'd say it's too bad that union dues can't be negotiated, and I would love to see us go on a percentage instead of a flat fee for our dues, because while we're concerned about these teachers in their first year who make such a little amount of money, they pay over 2% of their income in union dues, versus teachers that have been there for a long time are down to about 1% and possibly less. So it would be nice if the union would consider that for those teachers down the road.
Madam Chair,
John.
Each year our representative convention, which is a democratic body, sets and establishes dues. There have been many times when your suggestion has been put to our membership in a democratic process that suggestion has been rejected. But I'm certain that if you were to lobby hard and work hard to move that representative convention, they may come to your point of view.
Mr. DeCraig, Senator DeCraig.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question. And I apologize because I had to step out to take a telephone call. But if you guys talked about this before, but I'm a business owner. And as a business owner, I buy my own health insurance. When healthcare costs go up, it's something that costs me money. Do you believe a teacher's benefits are an increase in pay when if a school picks up a larger portion of those benefits? Is that an increase in pay or no?
Madam Chair,
Mr.
Senator.
DeCraig.
Yes, that's costed. If the employer picks up a larger portion of that premium cost, that's costed into the package and considered as part of the cost of it. Sadly, as premiums have gone up over the last 10 years, employers have been assuming a smaller and smaller portion of that increase, and our members have been assuming a larger portion of it. In most of our districts, the employer's contribution is capped at a dollar figure, and so in the second year of the contract, if there's a premium increase, the employees eat that whole premium increase. So it is a cost. It's a cost for everybody, and we do have to wrestle that problem to the ground, too.
Madam Chair and Senator DeCraig, we actually have a solution for you if you would like to figure out how to control school employee health insurance costs.
Okay.
Are there any other questions? If not, thank you very much, and I'm sure there's going to be continued dialogue, and thank you for participating in it. Is this what happened to Senator Nelson? Did she take the
chair? Senator Nino is your chair.
Well, she did. Senator Nino, could you take the gavel?
Senator Olson, you are going to be presenting to the committee House File 2083, correct?
Yes, I believe. Yes, it's House File 2083.
And
thank you.
Senator Olson, are you wanting to lead off with an author's amendment? Is that what you intend?
Yes, I am. We are not accepting the House language, it's a rather thick bundle. When the bill that I introduced that was the counterpart to the House bill was fairly simple. It just moves the payment of the for the shift back to a 70-30, and that was the essence of it. But when the bill that we've been hearing about has been much more voluminous and includes more things in terms of what the House has acted on. So I've got an oral amendment to the A4 amendment, but that is the delete all, which is a little less than 1.5 pages.
Okay.
Senator Olson, what is it on the A4 amendment that you would like different?
On the page 2, line 11, erroneously left in this amendment were the words "and benefits," and I would like those deleted.
Okay, so Senator Olson offers the A4 amendment minus those two words on line 2.11, minus the words "and benefits." Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right, I will treat this as an author's amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion carries. The amendment is adopted. Senator Olson, would you like to present your bill as amended?
Yes. The main part of it is the change in the shift, the payment of aides to the school district, which has been 60-40 since the...
are we actually getting this thing now?
Since the last... In the 2011 fiscal year, to 64.3 in year 2012. That is what is accomplished by the 300 and approximately 15 or so million that by current statute, after the cash flow and the budget reserve accounts were reached the statutory cap, that would go for repaying any shifts. So that brought it to 64.3, and this would move it to 70 in the fiscal year 2013 and later. So what the purpose of this is to restore the payment schedule that was in effect at the beginning of our last term when we were confronting our last budget. There, we've done, and I'm sure this has created a little angst for those who have seen this, because we started the discussion with Senator Perry's bill and the state government on a broader scale yesterday. But this is a slight modification of that, that instead of all of the things like LIFO and a few other things that were in it, this is a provision that we felt might be a tool in managing for districts to manage their money and efforts, and that is that the contract term that when it expires does not include any of the increases that are the steps and lanes that are in the continuing contract. That is just put on hold. It doesn't stop the payment for an ongoing at the previous level, but it would not allow for increases until that contract is settled, and so that is the additional provision that is in this amendment, and in would be in the Senate bill. And for that agreement that has been affected, you'll note that it was not an intent to limit the end benefits to the levels, and it's just to limit the wages to the levels and amounts in effect on the effective date of this section.
Senator Bonner, if you had a question.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Senator Olson, going back to the shift part of the bill, a few questions that I have is, are you then assuming that the move to 70 is coming from, if we don't have it, does come from the reserves? That'd be one question. And then also, when we first went to the 70 under Governor Pawlenty, prior to that we were under 90-10, and by statute we still had to pay that back to get to 90-10. Every new dollar that came over the reserve number was to be used to get us back to 90-10. And so it looks like in this language that, in fact, once we got, or that in 2012 we would just get to 70, so assuming that we would have the money in the reserves, and I don't know where we would get it if we didn't have it. So the question is, where's the money coming from? And then the other question is, what is your thinking that would just accept staying at 70 in perpetuity versus the 90-10?
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The purpose is to get it back to the 70. It doesn't change the statute so that any additional resources that come in, any additional funding that would bring the budget reserve up to that cap and go over that would automatically go to continuing to buy back that reserve. That hasn't, would not have changed that. Because this the 70-30 payment still does not erase getting to 90-10. There's still 40% there.
So, Senator Olson, what you're saying is this language does not notwithstand the other statute. The other statute could still be in effect.
Right.
Senator Bonner, if you follow.
Well, I did not put in specifically, where it comes from. This goes to finance afterwards, and we thought we could tend to any changes that would be needed to clarify that there. But the reality, for your sake, is that the combination of the filled cash flow and the remaining part of the reserve is just shy of $600 million. So $600 million is more than we've had for many years in any kind of a reserve for managing both the cash flow and any other circumstances. And one would hope that if things are slightly improving, that in the next few months, we don't know that, but that if that process continues, that should be quickly refilled.
Senator Bonoff.
Mr. Chair, then Senator Olson, it says that in 70, in fiscal year 2011, 64.3 in fiscal year 2012, and 70 in fiscal year 2013 and later. So I'm just worried, should this pass, that it would preclude the 90-10. Mr. Nauman?
Mr. Nauman, could you help us with that? If that's not, certainly not an intent.
Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, Senator Olson, no, it would not preclude the 90%. The way the statutes hold hands together is in 16A-152 subdivision 4, I think. I'm not sure I got that subdivision proper. It essentially overwrites the permanent statute that you have in place here. So it notwithstands this language. So if this were to become law, we would fund it 90%, and in the next forecast, assuming there's a positive number, they would essentially, the Department of Education would overwrite this statute and would pay based on a higher number.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chair, just out of curiosity, I think there was a $1.1 billion deficit forecasted for the next budget deficit, and that was including the good news of this particular deficit. So is it possible to get Mr. Showalter to comment on this particular provision?
Is he here?
Yeah, I think that's him over there.
I'm sorry, I didn't look.
Senator Tomasoni, the intent of the chair was to ask if anyone wanted to speak to the two different provisions within the bill as we have it before us. So if the committee is done with this, now would be a perfect time for the commissioner. Welcome to the committee, commissioner.
Mr. Chair, the bill, and I was here just to see what the committee was going to be looking at regarding the reserve and the shifts. Understand that it's been changed and appreciate the amendment because, really the reserves are there to handle risks, as the MSBA talked about earlier. Schools need reserves in order to protect themselves from unforeseen circumstances. The state's protecting the schools from unforeseen circumstances, and it totally stands to reason that we try to make sure that that happens.
Thank you, because that is, one thing that the schools will have the challenge, even though we adjust that payment schedule, is that it's still, this is a one-time money. This is not, new money for spending, and I would hope that for those who have gone into short-term borrowing that they could correct that stance as well as start filling some of their reserves, which we in fact took essentially to use to solve our problem.
Members, any questions?
Did I hear Mr. Showalter give an opinion about this? I don't know if I did.
Mr. Showalter, could you clarify your statement for Senator Tomasoni?
Mr. Chair, Senator, perhaps I should have the question restated, and I'll try to make sure I hit it correctly.
Well, I think what this does is it takes some of the surplus money. I'm not sure which amount it does, but is this about $400 million worth of?
Senator Tomasoni, I believe the net result would leave about $600 million between cash flow and reserves. Is that correct, Senator Olson?
Yeah.
It would leave that.
Does anybody?
Yes, it does. The 300 and some million that is by current law, and an additional 420 would bring it back to the 70. And let it get the schools out of having to short-term borrow.
Senator Olson, Senator Tomasoni, Commissioner, just to clarify, my comment that I just made is operating under the presumption that the money would come out of cash flow and reserves accounts. Your bill does not specify that.
That's correct.
And Senator Tomasoni. Now I should probably have Commissioner Showalter give me what you're reading out of this.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator, if I may capture the discussion, I would like to, if I may, we would like to just make sure we understand exactly what's going on. I want to clarify with fiscal staff. Could I just ask Eric Nauman to just briefly walk through the specifics and the mechanics?
Mr. Nauman, would you enlighten us?
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, and members, Section 1 of the amendment, first on line 1.25, codifies the shift level at 64.3% for the forecast for fiscal year 2012. Then beginning in fiscal year 2013, the shift would increase to 70% for fiscal 13 and later. There is no revenue source identified. So there's about $415 million of expenditure associated with the adjustments to the K-12 appropriations beginning in fiscal 13 that would presumably be required.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, thank you for that. Explanation. It didn't do quite what I thought it had done, but because, as I understand it, it is still basically advancing the shift repayment further than where we were able to, given the improvement of the forecast. It's sort of doing one of two things. It's either creating a deficit in the next forecast, or it's sort of grabbing an anticipation of further forecast improvements in the future. That would obviously cause concern. We would want to make sure that if there are changes in the payment obligations in statute, that we know where the money is coming from at this point in time, so that we still have a balanced budget going forward, so we know where we're at. I would really not want to be going to the rating agencies this summer and say, by the way, we created a $400 million hole. Yeah, we've got reserves replenished, but we have a $400 million hole because of new shift obligations that we haven't specified yet.
Okay. Now I understand.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rieger.
Yes. And Commissioner, could this create serious cash flow problems for districts as early as October?
Commissioner Showalter.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't believe it would create cash flow problems for districts in as much as they already are anticipating a significantly lower aid payment percentage from the state. Where you're likely to see the most immediate cash flow implications are from the state side, where due to lower budget reserves and the cyclicality of our payments and timing of payments, we're almost certain to be, at best, scraping for every nickel in the Treasury to make our education payments come September and October.
Commissioner Showalter, I was trying to wade through some of the graphs and things in terms of that cash flow, because I would think that that would be a discussion in the Finance Committee of if there's any modifications of the implementation or the flow of this that could mitigate that aspect. So I'd like you to consider that as well, because that's not our intent to complicate things here. But I think it's a good faith effort to let the schools know that we don't intend to keep withholding that. And when we do have it, if we can help and not totally jeopardize our position either,
that we should be paying those adjustments and corrections so that they don't have to continue to short-term borrow or function with a greatly diminished or non-existent fund balance to manage their cash flow problems. So that's the philosophy behind this.
Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner Schulter, just real quickly, and please forgive me if you did this, I had to step out of the room a couple of minutes ago. Could you give us, you know, a brief history of what's been done with these reserve accounts in the past few years and what the balances might be, and speak to what this legislation could potentially leave us with as far as those reserve accounts and compare that to what we've been dealing with over the last 2-3 years?
Commissioner Showalter.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I will see if I've got literally the numbers on hand. Assuming I don't, I'm going to give you a narrative sort of some of a brief history of reserves. And I don't. But going back, basically the reserve levels go back, I'd say, to the early 90s in the Carlson administration when they were statutorily set. Prior to that, they were, I think, less defined. Really, it was sort of money on the bottom line. So a cash flow account and a budget reserve were both set up at that point in time, pretty much at the levels that you still see today. Those reserves were replenished and created and replenished and maintained all the way through to year 2000. When the recession started to hit in the early 2000s, those reserves were drawn down. At the same time, we had a tobacco endowment of over $1 billion that was also available for cash purposes and really, frankly, for budget management purposes. And so even as the budget reserve was drawn down to zero, that $1 billion was still there. When that was liquidated, we started building the budget reserve back up. It took precedence over repaying the shifts, which were also used at that same time, because keeping the state's own fiscal house in order, having some ability to manage things, was memorialized in law, and it's kind of the sort of common financial practice not to pass that risk along to other parties. So we started building the reserves back up by around 2005. The shifts were repaid, the budget reserves were restored. That was the case until the last few years. When the latest recession hit, we started drawing it back down. When he went into the last forecast, about a year ago, we were down to a couple $100 million. By the time we were issuing the budget, by the end of the 12 and 13 biennium, we were down to like $125 million. That neighborhood was really quite small. That started to get replenished through the last two forecasts, where the statutory triggers started to push us back up to the about roughly $1 billion between the two accounts. That's where we stand right now. After this is done, all said and done, that would pull it back to around $600 million. I would just point out that where we had been was not a good place. And the reasons for the statutory triggers are really quite simple. So that we can make sure as a state we've got some margin of cushion, because we know our forecasts go up and down. Dr. Stinson talked in this room at the forecast release about how even this far into the budget biennium, we have on average about $1 billion swings. Either way. So I can't even at this point testify to you and say, you know, on average, I know we've got enough money to get through this budget biennium without further budget adjustments. On average, we're about where we should be, but if we start to spend down that reserve, you know, even just on a budgetary basis, we're banking on hope.
Senator Cruz.
But Mr. Chair and Commissioner Showalter, I guess I just want to make sure that I'm hearing you. Even if we're left, you know, we're talking about if this legislation were to go in place and we pull this money, or we would still have the $420 million set in the reserves, and we would still have the $300 that would be in the cash flow account, which would leave us. Am I correct in that, or am I misinterpreting that?
The difference is it's about close to $600 million between the two, $350 and whatever makes up to $690-something.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, that's kind of where I was going with that 600, arguably $600 million compared to where we've been the past couple of years with what you mentioned is right around $100 million is what you were saying, with from the past previous couple of years, 3 years. I'm optimistic that we're moving in the right direction, and I'm kind of saying in the grand scheme of things, if we can kind of take care of both and still continue to move in the right direction with our budget reserves, that maybe that's a healthy way to go.
And Mr. Chair, Senator, that's an excellent point. We're certainly in a better space than we were a year ago. After three consecutive positive forecasts or forecasts that made our situation better, I would hope we would be in a better space. And we should be in a significantly better space. I think the question for the legislature is how much risk do you want to pass along to the programs, to the taxpayers for the rest of this biennium and going into the next one? Because that's what the reserves are. It's like, as a family, I've got life insurance, and I could give my kids the premiums and say, you know, congratulations, you got the premiums, you're good, but you have no life insurance on your dad. I don't think that's exactly where we want to be. And the state in this responsibility has some need to make sure we've got the wherewithal to take on the risks of unforeseen circumstances.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, I would argue in response to that I feel pretty comfortable about where we would be leaving the state with a $600 million cushion when we got here and it was only a $100 million cushion. I would argue the moving in the right direction. I'm feeling a lot more comfortable now than I was when I first got here. So I would say if it's the security argument and you're right, I agree with everything that you're saying. I think it is prudent to set aside a certain amount of money for a rainy day fund because rainy days happen. We do need to take care of that. And I feel like, you know, to the tune of 600%, we've increased that fund. If this legislation passes, as of right now in the forecast, you know, we're sitting at, like you mentioned, right around $1 billion. I'd say there's a little room to maybe allow this legislation to go through, make sure that we do catch up on those payments to our school and take care of this shift.
Senator Bonner.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, I remember when the shift happened last time around and the threat of the shutdown, et cetera, we did get downgraded. We got on our credit rating. And so I have a couple questions, but one of them, do you think that this would help or hurt with regard to that situation if, in fact, we did pass this legislation without knowing what would be in our reserves?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonner, I believe it would certainly not help and probably would hurt somewhat. And the reason is very simple, that reserves and the amount of cash that the state has on hand is an important factor. Part of the reason we got downgraded was we needed to do a lot of short-term solutions. And as we look forward, cash management is going to be a continuing issue for us. And if we're trying to get back to a much healthier AAA kind of position, it's going to be an and situation where we'll repay the shifts and maintain adequate reserves.
Well, and that was my second point, just to remind members that this committee did put into law in 2004 the process for the minute we get a dollar over the reserves, it's 100% dedicated to education. And so that's why I feel comfortable that I agree, Senator Cruz, we are going in the right direction and we may very well get to this, but I am uncomfortable doing it because I also remember over the last couple of years looking at the charts where we didn't have the cash to pay our bills. And so I'm also worried about the cash flow, and I would just ask either you or Mr. Nauman your opinion about the cash flow. Would we go into red if we were to do this with this scenario?
Is there a comment from either?
Mr. Nauman.
If not, Senator Hand has a question.
I can address it. Mr. Chair, Senator, I didn't bring all my cash flow information as I came over here, but the quick summary is that we have given information on daily cash balances estimated through the course of fiscal 13 to the fiscal staff, to the finance chairs, and we show very small balances for the first couple months going into negative balances for September or starting in fall. And to take another $400 million out of our cash balances would literally just shift that down somewhat. It wouldn't shift it by the same amount, but it would certainly make it somewhat worse.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Nauman, the effect on schools do you see?
Madam Chair and Senator Bonoff, I think the commissioner has aptly put the issue that the cash challenge is more with respect to this immediate bill, one for the state, less for the districts. That I'll point out that over about a 60-day period, we make the cleanup payment to schools. So there's a big lump payment because of the lagging payment that occurs in the late August through late October time period, and that's a big exfusion of dollars out of the state coffers into the districts in the form of school district cleanup payments. I think that's probably why the commissioner is citing that period as one that's got more challenge than other points in the year.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Showalter, I just want to ask you, you were speculating a moment ago about what the effect on the credit rating may or may not be. And I just wanted to ask you again to maybe speculate a little bit. If last spring when we got done with the budget and as a part of the budget spending side being unchanged from what we did agree to, but on the other side, if we would have had $600 million in reserves and no change in the education shift from what it had been the budget period before, would we have been downgraded in our credit rating?
No. Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the scenario is we would have maintained our reserves and we would have maintained our spending level? Was it?
No, I'm just saying that if the budget, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Showalter, if the budget agreement we reached last year kept the spending side as it was, but had left on the balance sheet $600 million in the reserve accounts as we have right now, and did not require any extension of the shift beyond what was already in place, which was a 70-30, which is what this would do, is restore to that, would we still have been downgraded in our credit? Or would we have been looked at as saying, well, that's pretty good under the circumstances? What would be your speculation on that?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator, excellent question. I'm not sure. I think the issue that they would have been raising, it would have been a two-part one, which is a structural balance. Had we addressed some way to get the state's structural balance into order? And, you know, frankly, the credit rating agencies started to tire of the one-time nature of our solutions. And that led to examination or sort of a compilation of other negative factors that led to the downgrade. If we had, in an expedient manner, found a budget solution that was structurally balanced with not full reserves, without more one-time resources, I think they might have hung with us speculating. They might not have, but certainly the risk around having a structural balance and having some wherewithal to handle our daily cash were some of the key issues for us. And the continuing inability to reach budget adjustments on a speedy basis.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, kind of hitchhiking on Senator Hand's question, is there, what's the relative merits in that process of determining that rating of what you have in reserves or reducing your obligation? Because that's, you know, we're taking care of one piece that was a chink in our challenge versus the other. Now we've got it up to, as he said, we've got $600 million that is in the reserve now, or would be after this, but we would have reduced an obligation or made some significant movement toward that. How do those balance out in terms of influence on those rating companies? Do you have any sense of that?
Mr.
That's
Chair.
I kind of see that you were getting at that, and that's kind of what my mind was working around, but in a little different way.
Mr. Chair, Senator, again, good question. And I would say that when we talk with rating agencies, it is looking at a whole lot of factors. They want to know everything that's going on, but ultimately they want to understand our approach to financial management, our discipline, our ability to manage risk so that any debt that the state has outstanding is very well secured, both on a practical basis because of our practices and just how we behave, and on a numbers basis because of the factors that can be objectively observed. To the extent that we have had in law for 20-odd years, a process of prioritizing reserves and then paying off shifts has been a credit positive. I'm not going to go any further about how they would treat a new practice, but certainly it has been a credit positive in the past that we make sure that we've got adequate reserves or at least minimum levels of reserves before we start to repay those shifts.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I want to talk with Senator Cruz and Senator Bonoff later to find out what stocks they're investing in, because they seem to be confident that something good is going to happen in the very near future. So that's a good thing. But let me ask this question, because I think I heard there's a 400.
Mr. Chair, Apple.
Apple. Yeah, I missed that one, just so you know.
Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, Fastenal has been doing pretty well, too.
I missed that one, too, Senator.
Our former colleague paid attention.
You guys should have told me all this stuff years ago. But my question, okay, so we have a 400. This creates a $415 million hole in the budget, if I understand correctly. I think what Senator Olson is pointing to is whatever's left in this of the fund balances that are being set aside as probably going to be the place we're going to draw it from. So it would be a one-time payment that would be applied to this coming year. Then I don't know if this is for Mr. Showalter or for Mr. Nauman or for both of you. Then I'm assuming that in the subsequent years, because it says and later on line 1.26, then we have another hole. Is that correct, or becomes part of the budget? How does
Senator
that,
Olson,
does that work?
Mr. Chair, we're I think probably already back to paying 100%. Of that, there we didn't cut the aid, we just shifted the payment schedule,
right.
And we're shifting that back for the money that we were able to attribute to our budget, and we're moving back and giving that back to the on a one time basis. We don't do it more than once. Any more money that we would put in would buy that percentage more, you know, up to heading toward the 90% to try to pay back the rest that it accumulated.
Senator Tomasoni, to the extent that accounting tool is used, you get a one-time benefit, and to the extent that you fix it, it's a one-time cost.
Mr. Chair, just in the interest of clarifying the point, Senator Tomasoni is correct. There is a small tail associated with it, mostly because we've got increasing pupil counts. So there is a $16 million effect, but we haven't yet balanced the 14-15 budget.
Great. Are we done? Are we done on this? Yeah, yes.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer the A3 amendment.
Do we have that? Okay, Senator Stevens offering the A3 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I can begin to explain how it works. Essentially, what this does is it pays back the additional $2 billion that the state owes our school children. So, Senator Olson, in your amendment, it would be 70-30, and this would go to 90-10. Members, when we arrived here in January of 2011, the budget called for a 90-10 school payment schedule, as Senator Bonoff mentioned. So the situation here is that whether we like it or not, the budget borrowed a record amount from our school districts, nearly $3 billion, which was irresponsible, in my opinion. Every Democrat on the floor voted no against that budget that borrowed so much money from our schools, and the Republicans voted yes. And now it seems, Senator Olson, with all due respect, that your amendment is trying to pay back some of that money that's owed, but in my analysis, it's only one-time money, and it doesn't pay the schools back in full. So what I'm proposing is paying the schools back in full by using a new source of revenue, a new source of income, which is, and I should also mention, this amendment would preserve the rainy day fund and use a fair funding source to repay the IOUs that we owe our schools. So the funding source is tax shelters and corporate tax loopholes. And it asks, really, essentially, we can talk about more details, but it asks Minnesota companies to play by the same rules that Main Street companies in Minnesota play by right now. So I think that this is the fiscally responsible thing to do, in that we are paying back our schools the full amount that they're owed. It doesn't, it's not an accounting gimmick, and it doesn't drain our rainy day funds. So,
Senator Sieben, do you how much money is this involved? Do you know,
Mr. Chair? The amendment would raise about $153 million in fiscal year 13, $110 million in fiscal year 14, and $115 million in 15. So the proceeds of the bill get allocated to the shift over time until the shifts are restored.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Hand.
Mr. Chairman, I just was wondering if there is a fiscal note or a revenue memo that would substantiate the dollars. I know we're not the tax committee, and I'm a little unsure about where these numbers are coming from, and I just think that if there's specific numbers attached to this, we ought to have some documentation of where they came from.
Senator Hand, Mr. Nauman has some input on that.
Mr. Chair and Senator Hand, that's a good question. We pulled the fiscal or the revenue note from earlier this year that confirms the numbers that Senator Sieben spoke to. We pushed the dates by 1 year because the effective date wasn't aligned with the original revenue estimate. But so with the proviso that we don't think we got it 100% right, but the order of magnitude is about right, about $150 million, then it drops down to about $110 million, and that grows by $3 or $4 million a year.
So, Senator Hand.
Mr. Chairman, and I guess to Senator Sieben, the author of the amendment, what is the effect on Minnesota businesses of putting this provision into law, and does this have any opposition to it? Is this an amendment that would be opposed by anyone?
Senator Sieben, before you answer that, Senator Hanna, in my failure to first give the author of the bill the opportunity to speak to the amendment, maybe she likes it. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, no, I'm not ready to jump on board with it. I have a question for Senator Sieben. Is what year do you expect that this would reach the 90-10? How long would it take, given the revenue flow that this tax would increase would
be paid back?
When would that?
Senator Sieben, to those two questions, I guess.
When you were describing initially, it looked like whatever you were doing was going to pay the whole lump at once, but it obviously is not the case. But how long will it take?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, the estimate is that it would take roughly 20 years to pay it back, although this would not preclude that if there is additional money that comes into the state from budget surpluses or whatever, that money could also be put towards paying that off more quickly.
Members, if we don't have any further questions, then I would ask, are those anyone in the room that would like to speak for or against this amendment? See some activity. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The chamber would oppose this amendment for a variety of reasons, and I'm not sure how much tax talk you want this afternoon, but each of the provisions in this bill would represent significant tax increases on our membership, and for those reasons we oppose them. Foreign operating corporation provision, for example, is founded in solid tax policy back in 1988 when it was when it was originated in Minnesota. It's designed to provide equal tax treatment to companies that are that have their foreign operations either incorporated domestically or abroad. And the foreign operating corporation structure provides that equal tax treatment for entities that incorporate their foreign operations inside the United States. So it's an important provision that we think is should be maintained in the state of Minnesota, and again oppose the foreign operating corporation change. Similarly, the foreign royalty deduction is also an important provision to keep high technology jobs and our R&D hub active in Minnesota. It's really the foreign royalty deduction and works to incent companies to develop R&D, develop intellectual property here, license it abroad. Those royalty payments are then taxed in Minnesota. 20% of those royalty payments are taxed in Minnesota. Again, that's a significant incentive to maintain the current high investment we have in the state with R&D companies in Minnesota. The tax haven provisions, we also oppose, and really, I guess the one way to look at this is the OECD used to maintain a list of countries that they considered tax haven countries. Right now, there are zero countries on the uncooperative tax haven list, and I just think that provision is obsolete. And then finally, maybe I'll just comment on one other provision of the bill. There's it would adopt what's known in the tax world as Finnegan apportionment, and that would be a significant disincentive for companies to locate in Minnesota if they don't have nexus, if they're not taxable in Minnesota already. In addition to that, it's certainly a tax increase on current Minnesota taxpayers because it imposes a new tax on their non-Minnesota affiliates that don't have nexus in Minnesota. So for all those reasons, we would oppose the amendment and urge you to vote against it. Thank you.
Mr. Hesse, the numbers that were given to us based off of the score on this previously somewhere else, the revenue into the state drops off precipitously the first couple of years and then builds back up again. Is there a dynamic there of companies closing shop and moving branches out, or can you talk to that?
Mr. Chair and members, I don't know exactly why the revenue estimate would drop off. That'd be a question for the Department of Revenue, I guess.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Hesse, do you know, I am not a member of the Tax Committee, this term tax haven, is that term defined anywhere else in statute, or is this the definition, and is that considered pejorative? So are we going to have diplomatic problems with Panama or Liechtenstein or Costa Rica by using that term? Do you know anything about that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Hand, thank you for reminding me. I think the nations on this list would certainly deem it to be pejorative. British consulate has weighed in and that provision already this year. In past years, Governor Plenty got a visit from the ambassador of Latvia and Luxembourg. I've spoken to the consulate of Liechtenstein. So there's a lot of folks around the world that are concerned with this provision. And basically, it goes back to, again, the OECD does not maintain an uncooperative tax haven list anymore. There's many treaties that nations have entered into with the United States based on transparency and sharing of information about taxpayers' situations. So, again, I think it's obsolete.
No other questions. I do see another witness at the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, my name is Jill Larson. I'm the Fiscal Policy Director at the Minnesota Business Partnership. I also want to go on record opposing the amendment. Echo Mr. Hesse's comments. I'll just add a couple of more. The foreign royalty deduction in particular is a huge benefit to Minnesota's med tech and high tech industry. It was put into place back in 1988 under the Purpich administration as a way to incent Minnesota companies to conduct R&D here, to have high paying R&D jobs here. We have one of the best med tech industries in the country, and this provision, if passed, would be a huge detriment to R&D activity in Minnesota. It also would have a negative ripple effect on the small and mid-sized companies that are the suppliers and vendors of the larger med tech companies in Minnesota. And so we oppose the amendment. And please keep in mind, members, that this would be a tax increase on top of the federal tax increase, the medical device tax increase that Congress passed It was a $20 billion tax increase, 25% of which is going to be borne by Minnesota EdTech companies. So this would be piling on in our view. And again, with respect to the tax haven language, as Mr. Hesse pointed out, the list that you see in this amendment is very much outdated. There is no list anymore. In fact, the Treasury Department, the U.S. Treasury Department, frowns upon such a list. They wrote a letter to the GAO when the GAO did a study on this a couple of years ago and said that there is no definition, there is no agreed-upon definition, and they don't like having a list because it hampers international relations. And so that's why we're hearing from these countries that don't like the bill. So I appreciate the time and be happy to answer questions. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wicker.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I understand where each of you are coming from on the proposed revenue, but what about the underlying bill for taking money from the reserves at that level? We've had commissioner testimony about whether that would impact the stability of our rating. Would you care to offer an opinion on that?
Ms. Chairman, Larson. Senator, we do not have a position on the bill as a whole.
Ms. Larson, I have a question. You made reference to negative impacts. I'm trying to put that into Main Street language. Does that mean that there would be reduced business growth, that there would be employee reductions or fewer employee adds? What does that mean?
Mr. Chairman, yes, there could be. Again, Minnesota is already a high-tax state. We have a high corporate tax. There's a lot of other states and countries that are trying to woo our businesses to expand elsewhere, locate elsewhere. And if this benefit is taken away, that's just one more disincentive to expand here, to add employees here. And these jobs can be sent overseas. And then we don't get any of the royalty income. Then all of the income stays there, and we lose not only the royalty income, we'll lose the individual income tax that we would get from the employees who are no longer here, the sales taxes from the items they would have purchased. So and that ripples through the med tech economy that is really thriving here.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before I ask you a question, follow up on what your statement, I want to say thank you, Senator Stephen, for bringing this and giving us this opportunity to really understand what is at stake here. This really gives us a sense of what do we want to do about paying for education and who wants to pay for it and how we want to pay for it. So that's the bottom line here. The bill might not be perfect, and the language may be offensive to Aruba, but bottom line is that we cannot tax corporations who are making millions of dollars. We instead are going to use our reserves, which the Pawlenty administration did for 8 years and ended up really with a deficit of $5.5 billion. That's what happened. So my question to you is, you keep saying time and time again that we cannot tax corporations because you cannot afford to pay for the education of our kids, because the job creators are going to leave the state of Minnesota. They're going to go and they're going to leave us without any money, without companies. And we're going to be so poor and so broke. I would like to know if you can point to me, what are the companies that have left Minnesota specifically because of our taxes? And what are the companies that have come here to do business in the state of Minnesota specifically because we have highly educated people that they want to hire? Please give me examples of the two, because those are the two things that corporations talk about and we talk about time and time again. If you tax these people, these individuals are going to go away because of taxes. So I want you to give me the list of the people who have left because of taxing. Not because, you know, I want that connection to be made, because that's the connection you want to make. I want you to give me the list of the people who came here to open companies because we have highly educated individuals that they want to hire in their companies. We have made that argument time and time again, and it is time for us to really provide the information. So I would like you to please give me that information, and if you don't have it right now, I would like to have it because we're going to engage in this conversation for years to come. This is a core issue for our two parties. This is a core issue about how are we going to pay for the education of our kids and pay $2.5 billion that we took away from schools this year, last year. We have to pay that. So somebody's going to have to pay. And we have fundamental differences about how are we going to make it. Fundamental differences between the two parties. So I need your help in trying to figure out, you know, who's telling us the truth.
Senator Cruz, you want to speak to that?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Torres-Ray. We'll try and take a little heat off of our testifiers here and keep the conversation between us. I can give you perfect...
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. I did ask a question from the testifiers. I did not ask a question from Senator Cruz.
And the chairman recognized Senator Cruz. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can give you some perfect examples. I have spent 16 years in the restaurant industry. I have worked... I have had abundant experience dealing with chambers of commerce and small businesses, and I can give you examples of restaurants that have left because of taxation. I can give you examples of hairdressers that have left out of Maple Grove with the North Hennepin Area Chamber of Commerce that I have seen. I have seen many, many, many small businesses close up. Maybe not leave our state, but small business owners close up and have to try and pursue
With all due respect, Mr. Chairman, with all due respect, this has nothing to do with foreign operating corporations.
Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And I think, but your point was you were asking for examples of where taxation were forcing companies to leave or go out of business.
This bill is about corporations.
Please work through the chair so we can maintain some order.
No, I want to be, Mr. Chairman, I want to be fair on my question and I want to be clear on the question. This bill is, I have the same experience, Senator Cruz, the same experience, and mostly related to tax increases on property taxes. I have the same experience. East Lake Street is empty of very small businesses that were, I'm not talking about those businesses, and I would love to have that conversation. This is about taxing corporations, and I am asking the two witnesses who talk, who have ample experience and said in their testimony that these corporations listed here will be leaving the state of Minnesota because we will be taxing them. I'm just talking about the bill, the amendment. So I want to know if you have the list that supports with evidence what you're talking about.
Senator Torres-Ray, they will have an opportunity to answer your question, but Senator Cruz had asked to address your particular point. Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chairman, you know, I think the question when you asked it, Senator Torres-Ray, you made it very specific that you were talking about broad differences between philosophical points of view from our parties. And the discussion here has developed to, does taxation at any level equal the closing or leaving of businesses? And you're right, that is a fundamental difference between our parties. It is. And I think that what you've seen happen at the local level with these small businesses like you and I are both seeing, I would respectfully disagree with you that it is a different conversation. It goes back to your point of the broad, does taxation equal these businesses leaving? And I would argue, yes, it does. And I think it's very important to remember, too, that the whole reason we're here talking about this right now is because we have a school shift that has gone back way before this legislature ever took over. When we took over, there was $1.7 billion locked up in school shift already. So I think that's an important part of this conversation, and I think we're moving in the right direction. And I hope that we would understand that Senator Olson's bill that's in front of us right now is a piece of making this better. And it does that while protecting our businesses, while leaving a significant amount of money in reserve accounts. This is the healthy option. This is not slamming the brakes on the car while it's driving 90 miles an hour down the road and it's going to throw everything off. No, this is moving in the right direction. This is healthy. So I think you're right. This is a fundamental difference, and I would argue that taxation on any level is going to push businesses away. And what I'm concerned about specifically with this amendment and what you're talking about with these corporations are, if these corporations leave, we've already hit our small business owners. Our small business owners are starting to go to some of these larger corporations that by the grace of God have had the ability to withstand the economic pressures that have been on them. And they're going to some of these businesses to find employment. If we chase them out of Minnesota, we're really going to be in a tough spot. We're really, really going to be in a tough spot.
So to Senator Torres-Ray, question, either of you have a response or both?
Sure, Mr. Chair. And
Mr. Hesse.
Senator Torres-Ray, you're correct that businesses, corporations depend on a quality workforce. They're also looking for the provision of government services at a competitive price. We can't forget about the price, the tax side of the equation. And there are many places around the country and many places around the world that provide a well-educated workforce that businesses can tap into. And a lot of those places, they do it for less tax cost than the state of Minnesota. So what businesses are really looking for is, yes, a quality workforce, but we have to find the value. We have to find the competitive cost that government places on businesses at the same time. So that's the challenge, and that's it's the challenge for this body and the legislature as a whole, is to find ways to provide not only education services but government services generally at an affordable price. Minnesota business taxes are high. Not only the corporate income tax, property taxes are also high. Personal income taxes for the small business that flows their business income through their personal return are high. We have lots of things to work on. The corporate income tax is one of those. So, yes, there are, businesses do pay attention to the rate of taxation in the state. And, many businesses over the years have made decisions based on the level of taxation in Minnesota. I think that's safe to say. And the next time you read the paper and see a decision of a major facility or plant or operate, a segment of a business moving or locating in some other state, it could be due in part, not solely, in part to tax climate in Minnesota. Could also be due to the availability of skilled workers.
Bring that up.
It could be, could be due to the fact that that's where their markets are growing. So there's lots of reasons why businesses locate, within the United States and around the world. But we firmly believe that the tax cost, that the tax taxes that are imposed on businesses is certainly one of them.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Thomas.
And Senator Torres-Ray was in the committee when we had a very credible witness in front of the Economic Development Committee who was a very successful businessman in the state of Minnesota. And he'll tell you that on a list of things that businesses consider, that taxes are 26th on the list. And that his experience and his experience with big business was that the education and the ability to produce an educated workforce was way more important than the level of taxes. And he pointed to the 7 highest tax states in the country as being the 7 most successful states in promoting businesses and having big businesses. So it's all a very interesting discussion. And if we continue to send the message that you are sending, that Minnesota is a high tax state, why would businesses come here if you think that's the reason they don't come here? Why don't you send the message that Minnesota is a great state to do business in, and that the reason we have a taxation level that we have is because we need to educate people and we need to provide services, and there's a reason that there's 5.5 million people in Minnesota and only 750,000 in North Dakota and South Dakota, which are states we often get compared to. So the taxation level is something that we hear a lot about. But at the same breath, you say Minnesota is a terrible place to do business in, yet you're the business people, and you should be the one sending the message that Minnesota is a great place to do business in and not a bad place to do business in.
Senator Daley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to the point of Senator Torres Ray's comments about Governor Pawlenty using reserves, and that's why we ended up with a $5 billion deficit. As I recall, at that time, Senator Torres Ray was in the DFL-controlled legislature and was part of that solution, I believe, along with some other folks here. And the $2.5 billion that was taken away from the children, the vast majority of that, two-thirds of it, was a result of the previous DFL-controlled legislators, the different agreements that they came up with, and only a small portion of that was what happened last year, $750 million. And the surplus that was announced in February went about almost halfway to address that. And with Senator Olson's measure here, we take care of that completely. And that delayed payment to the schools is gone. So I think this is a good measure. I know it's not to the amendment, but I just wanted to have a few comments about some what I look at as misleading numbers. Just want to set that straight.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have a question on the amendment, but I did want to just comment about the discussion on taxes. And I certainly agree that not every company leaves, and those who do don't leave entirely for tax burdens and so forth, but clearly it is a factor, and I think that's been demonstrated over and over again. And I think the real question is not that higher taxation necessarily drives every company out of the state, but the question you have to ask is if you take money, continue to take larger and larger percentages of money from corporations, the question is what would they have done with that money had we not taken it? Would that have gone to provide more jobs? Would that have gone to provide more research and investment? Would that have gone to provide more charitable giving? I think those are the questions you have to ask. When you take the money, what are you losing? Yes, we are bringing it over to the state. Yes, the state gets to spend it to do whatever it's going to do. But it's very, very hard to, with precision, quantify what is lost, because what we do as a state is very visible. What all the hundreds and hundreds of corporations do individually is very hard to see. And that's why it's an easy solution to propose a tax, because it's hard to see the effect that that has on all the hundreds of businesses that are affected. But I did want to ask a question of the amendment that we're, I guess, debating. Going back to, and maybe Senator Sieben would care to answer, the list, I want to go back to this tax haven list in Section 5. And I want to ask Senator Sieben, what is the criteria that this list was generated? What are the things that were spelled out and said, we're going to define a tax haven, and then we looked at all the countries in the world, and these countries came up as qualifying by that list? What are the criteria that apply in your bill or your amendment that would make a country a tax haven? Can you explain that to us?
Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair and Senator Hand, it's my understanding that the companies that are on this list are countries, that if you look on lines 5.12 to 5.16, the United States doesn't have tax treaties or other agreements with those foreign jurisdictions. And I think that we can debate the merits of whether we should be protecting corporate money that is sheltered in places like Gibraltar and Grenada or Aruba. But the point here is that we have a choice. And to Senator Daley's point that we as DFL legislators bear some culpability for the magnitude of the shift that we're facing, I would just answer that we're the adults in the room now, and we owe it to our school children to come up with a plan to begin to pay back the shift. And Senator Olson, I appreciate that your bill begins to move towards that direction, but again, it only goes to the 70-30 shift, or the 70-30 proportion, and my amendment before you, members, brings us a mechanism to pay that back more. I didn't intend, I appreciate the discussion. This isn't I didn't intend to offer it as a way to discuss the totality of Minnesota's business climate. I think that if you look at the at the amendment. It's really dealing more specifically. It's specifically dealing with tax havens, FOC loopholes. It would disallow the deduction of real estate investment trust, which is something that Governor Pawlenty proposed in 2010. So, again, to look at this at on a higher altitude, we're asking whether corporations that shelter some of their income in foreign companies should be allowed to do that, or if we should ask them to pay the same share, the same proportion of taxes that Main Street businesses pay, that other Minnesota companies pay. So with that, I think that this is an important enough issue that we should have a roll call on this. So, Mr. Chair, I'd request a roll call.
Roll call has been requested. We will have a roll call. Senator Sieben, I share your concern about making sure that we are able to get this shift paid back, and this certainly is one approach to do it. If indeed you are not successful here today, pay close attention to a bill that I have introduced on the agenda tomorrow that will do the same thing in about the same time frame without any tax increases or putting jobs at risk. Senator DeCryf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I might ask if maybe one of the testifiers could respond to a couple things that I'm about to say. But number one, something that I looked at a lot last year was a study that was put out by the Small Business and Entrepreneurs Councils, where it ranked 18 different tax points in Minnesota and all of the 50 states. And so it didn't just take one tax bracket. It didn't just take income tax. It didn't take real estate tax. It took across the board 18 different tax points, and they ranked all 50 states for tax purposes, the best to the worst. And in that study, it had Minnesota ranked 50th, dead last, and as being the worst state in the nation for tax purposes if you were a small business or an entrepreneur. And so I'd like, if you could, in just a minute to comment on that. And one other thing, I know Senator Torres Ray was asking about a company that left Minnesota because of its taxes, and I was wondering if he might comment on the sale of Northwest Airlines to Delta and why Delta left.
Mr. Hesse?
Mr. Chair and Senator DeCryf, I'm not sure I can comment on the latter question, but on the former, the small business rankings, there are things in that ranking that I think are good and some that maybe are not so good. And the not so good part of the rankings, I've never thought the way they handle unemployment insurance taxes was proper. They say because Minnesota has a high maximum tax rate that's a bad indicator, where for most businesses that don't lay off a large number of people, because we have a high maximum rate, we experience rate it, the UI system, pretty broadly, and that allows those companies that don't lay off significant amounts of people to have much lower UI taxes. So at least on that one indicator, I've always questioned why entities use that as a negative for Minnesota. I mentioned already the fact that we have a high, certainly nominal rate on the corporate income tax. We have high business property taxes. The Minnesota Taxpayers Association ranking lists us around 10th highest for a $1 million commercial property in the largest urban center of each state. Industrial rankings are somewhere in the neighborhood of 14th or 15th highest. So we do have and face high tax burdens. And so in large part, but we may not be 50th, but we certainly do face some high tax burdens in Minnesota.
Members, if there's no other discussion, no other questions, we can move on to a vote. I just want to make sure, is there anyone else that wanted to speak to this amendment that's in the room? Okay, I don't see any, so then we will move on to a vote. Members, I gave you a little tease, but since I have my own bill to do the same thing without a tax increase, the chair votes no. The clerk will take the roll.
Senator Bonoff?
No.
Senator Chamberlain?
No.
Senator Daley?
No.
Senator DeCryf?
No.
Senator Hahn?
No.
Senator Harrington?
Yes.
Senator Cruz?
No.
Senator Olson?
No.
Senator Sieben?
Yes.
Senator Stumpf? Senator Thompson?
No.
Senator Tomasoni?
Yes.
Senator Torres Ray?
Yes.
Senator Uyghur?
Yes.
Senator Wolf?
No.
There being 5 ayes and 10 nays, the amendment is not adopted. Senator Olson, do you have any further discussion or explanation on your bill, or is there any further questions from the committee?
I renew my motion to pass House File 2083 as amended to the Finance Committee.
Mr. Chairman, roll call.
There will be a roll call on the motion. Before that, Senator Torres Ray.
For your integrity and how you brought this to us in the form that you wanted, that you brought this to address the issue that you wanted to address without attaching things that would make it controversial.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that is a very important thing to know.
Something like contracts.
And so I want to tell you that I do appreciate that. You know, Senator Daley said something important, and I was here for 4 years. I voted to increase revenue in order to address the shift, and I disagree with Governor Pawlenty and the approach that he took to take this funding and leave us with $5.5 billion. I don't want to use this to blame each other, but the reality is that we needed to increase revenue in order to take care of this. We will use some of this money. You know, you're going to pass this. We will see what the future says. I hope that our economy goes in the direction that it has been going and that we do okay and we pay this because we need to do that. My experience in my first 4 years with the Pawlenty administration told me using these revenues is not a good idea, and that's why I would not vote for it. I do believe very firmly that after my first 4 years in the Senate, I learned that in order to resolve this problem, we need to increase revenue. So I just wanted you to know that I applaud your effort to bring a clean bill to the Senate. I just disagree with how it's being done because I had my experience for 4 years. I do believe we need revenue, and I do encourage you to help us get there. So just wanted that for the record.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Torres Ray, thank you very much. And my mission is to assure that we're getting the most and the best bang for the bucks we now spend. Because we are a high-tax state, and we do believe in these things, but I don't know that we always are getting the return. We invest in things, and we don't get results. And I think that's been a mission that I have attempted to convey. And I think there's been a fairly broad agreement that we do, if we are spending money, whether it's in education and for various things, we should find out why it isn't moving the needle, whether it's on the achievement gap or the overall student achievement. We do need to get the return on the investments that we're making. And if we just continue to pour more money at things, it doesn't necessarily mean that that will improve things. And so that tension, I think, will always exist. And there also being differing views. But I hope that we can continue to not – obviously, we need money, but we spend a lot of it. And hopefully we will be able to have some of the reforms and the challenges and the recognize the innovation and have the freedom to replicate it so that we can get good results for all of our children.
Yep. Members, we have a couple of people that want to speak here. If there's anyone in the room that wants to speak to this before we take a final vote, please come to the table. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I want to echo Senator Torres-Ray's comments because it has been such a privilege to share districts with you, and I've learned so much from working with you and do champion all of your reform efforts. So I always hate when I don't vote with you. But I am not going to vote for this bill. And the reason why is because I do hate the shift, but we pay, you know, we're now back at the 100%. You do the 60-40, so they're now getting their money, and they are, those who borrowed are borrowing at historically low interest rates. And so not to minimize the gravity of this shift, but I am committed. And after we did this shift, I just said to myself that I was going to be 100%, you know, line drawn in the sand, that I'm going to follow sound fiscal policy. And so I do want to stick to the level of reserves and using that kind of as my compass. So it's not that I don't appreciate or support doing it.
Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Olson, I too want to compliment you for bringing this bill up and not bringing up the House bill. But I got to tell you that we're delving into collective bargaining again, and I just am totally opposed to doing that. And I'm inclined to offer an amendment to delete sections 2 and 3 of the bill, because at least if I could probably vote for the first part of the bill, but I can't vote for the rest of it. And so if it's all there together, I think I'd have a problem with it. So I don't know, maybe
Mr. Chairman,
Ms. Elsweiger would like to comment on that.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, so you would want me to have no basis for some negotiation with the House?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, I got a funny feeling you'd keep that in.
Before you, Ms. Elsweiger, Senator Daley, did you want to?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a point of clarification, maybe for both Senator Torres Ray and for Senator Bonhoff. In 2007 and 2008, the cash flow account and the reserve account exceeded $1 million. However, in 2009 and 10, it was $1 million. That'd be a billion. So in 2007, 2008, over a billion in each year. So $350 million in the cash flow account, $653 million in the cash flow account, specifically in 2007, and about the same in 2008. So in 2009, $350 million in the cash flow account and none in reserve, and $266 million in the cash flow account and none in reserve in 2010. What we would have in this cash flow account and the reserve account far exceeds what the DFL-controlled majority in 2010 and 2009 approved. So when you were here, you approved something in the cash flow account and the reserve account that's going to be, that was much less than what we are suggesting we have, which would approach almost $600 million, more than twice as much as your approved amount in 2010. So I don't know if we're supposed to be encouraging other members to vote for it, but based on your vote in the past to approve that, I would encourage you to be a yes vote on this. Senator Olson's bringing forward a very good measure in a fiscally responsible way in something that's far stronger than what was approved in the past in 2009 and 2010.
Mr. Chair, to that point.
Senator Bonner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Daley, I wouldn't assume how I voted on any one particular thing unless you're looking at some particular vote. So so I just would ask you to speak in general terms and not use the "you" as in approve.
You know, Senator Daley, I first took office in 2003. We had what turned out to be a $4.5 billion deficit. And then I left office in 2007. We had $1 billion in the bank. The shift had been paid back. Everything was looking good. And I was out of office for 4 years and came back again to what turned out to be a $5 billion deficit, no cash in the bank. And I know correlation isn't causation, but I'm just saying.
Mr. Chairman, take credit for
Senator
it.
Senator Wager.
Mr. Chair, just on the point, and you know, Senator Daley, there was an ultimate agreement, but that was preceded by many bills that the majority DFL passed that did provide revenue for schools and what we thought was a more stable, responsible approach. I don't want to go down the partisan road, but you know, I think you're leading that, and I want to point out there were attempts to raise revenue. Senator Sieben has brought one of those items that we've actually voted on several times in the past. So this is nothing new. And I just want to point that out for the record.
Sure. Members, and we can delve back into this, but poor Ms. Allswager has been sitting at the table patiently waiting. Ms. Allswager, would you like to comment on the bill here before we vote?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jan Allswager, Education Minnesota. We would certainly support taking out Sections 2 and 3 because this does affect teachers and school employees in our school districts. Just some thoughts for you. On line 2.5, it says that you would not be able to pay any QComp money to people who have earned that additional performance pay, and that would be for the year previous because you get the QComp money the year after you actually prove your performance. I think that's contrary to the thinking of many in this body. Also, what you are doing is saying that we are going to let the younger people on staff, the least experienced, I should say, people on the staff in that school district not be paid their steps and lanes. While those who have been there 20 years and are at the top of the step, they won't see any harm in terms of their salary. They would QComp, certainly. So this is actually penalizing those teachers who are newer in the district. I think that is contrary to some of the discussion that you have had in the past. And then I would just like to quote from the MSBA newsletter. You know that you took away the January 15th contract settlement deadline, which was one of the pieces of legislation that fostered very improved labor negotiations in this state. And the only time we have strikes is when the January 15th deadline is not in place. So we have a year now of bargaining where there is no January 15th deadline. So I quote the MSBA newsletter. This is the August of 2011. As a result of the repeal of the penalty, school districts should no longer feel pressure to, quote, rush, unquote, to reach bargaining settlements with their local teachers' unions. That's the message that the school boards are sending, the School Board Association is sending to their school board members. Those are the same school board members who are working with our teachers. Those are the same teachers who want to get a settlement. This Section 2 and Section 3, we do not feel makes sense in the light of what I've just mentioned. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move to delete Section 2 and 3 from the bill.
Senator Tomasoni has moved to delete Sections 2 and 3. Senator Olson?
I would oppose the amendment.
Is there any further discussion?
I'd like a roll call, Mr. Chairman.
Seeing no further discussion, a roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Mr. Chair?
No.
Senator Bonoff?
Pass.
Senator Chamberlain?
No.
Senator Daley?
No.
Senator DeCryf?
No.
Senator Hahn?
No.
Senator Harrington?
Yes.
Senator Cruz?
No.
Senator Olson?
No.
Senator Sieben?
Yes.
Senator Thompson?
No.
Senator Tomasoni?
Yes.
Senator Torres Ray?
Yes.
Senator Weaker?
Yes.
Senator Wolf?
No.
Senator Bonoff?
Senator Bonoff?
Yes.
There being 6 ayes and 9 nays, the motion fails. Amendment is not adopted.
I would renew my motion.
Senator Olson renews her motion that House File 2083, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to
Finance.
There's no further discussion. A roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Senator Bonoff?
No.
Senator Chamberlain?
Yes.
Senator Daley?
Yes.
Senator DeCryf?
Yes.
Senator Hahn?
Yes.
Senator Harrington?
No.
Senator Cruz?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
Yes.
Senator Sieben?
No.
Senator Thompson?
Yes.
Senator Tomasoni?
No.
Senator Torres-Ray?
No.
Senator Uyghur?
No.
Senator Wolf?
Yes.
There being 9 ayes and 6 nays, the motion is adopted. The bill is sent to finance. Senator Olson, do we have anything else to come before the committee?
I don't believe we do today, but we will be meeting tomorrow and Thursday.
Right.
So we will march on.
Our meeting.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members.
Our meeting is adjourned.